Welcome to This Conversation. I'm your host, Teresa Keller. This conversation is brought to you by First Bank and Trust, alliances built on integrity and mutual trust and customer service that exceeds expectations. First Bank and Trust Company is where relationships are built to last, serving Southwest Virginia since 1979. And my guest today is Jerry Ann Haislett. Jerry Ann is author of the book, Anatomy of a Trial, Public Loss, Lessons Learned from the People versus O.J. Simpson. Jerry Ann, welcome to this conversation. I am so excited to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
I was so excited when I saw the information come in about this book and it had a phone number to call for an interview. I was on the phone immediately. If people who are listening today are not over 25 years of age, they might not know the O.J. Simpson trial. But I've always described that trial as the trial with the most famous murder defendant in the history of the universe. Is that true?
I think that was true until Michael Jackson's child molestation trial. I think he eclipsed O.J. Simpson as being the most famous. Oh, did you say murder defendant?
Yeah, murder defendant.
Oh, I beg your pardon, then I think you're right.
Because O.J. Simpson was famous as an athlete, as an actor, and he was famous not just in this country but around the world.
That's true.
All right. And you became intimately involved in this trial by virtue of your position in the Los Angeles Superior Court, where the book describes you as media liaison, but is that also a PIO, as in public information official?
That's correct.
All right. So you are in charge of the media, which has been often described as a media circus surrounding this trial.
It has been.
Well, fascinating. But before we get into the details of the lessons learned, public loss and lessons learned, as the title of the book says, let's just have you review, if you would, a bit about the case. What was the trial about?
The trial involved a double murder. O.J. Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and a man named Ron Goldman were murdered outside the door of Nicole Brown's condominium in Brentwood, California. They both had been slashed with a knife, and O.J. Simpson became the suspect. I don't know how quickly police focused in on him, but he became the primary suspect, and I think the case was really set with what is now called the infamous White Bronco slow speed chase. Apparently, O.J. Simpson had some idea that he was going to flee, not be arrested, and he and a football friend of his got in his White Bronco and were driving on the freeways of Los Angeles. The police blocked the entrances and exits while this vehicle went at a relatively slow speed on the freeways. And the overpasses became crowded with people shouting, holding signs, cheering, lined the sides of the roadways and so forth. That kind of set the stage for and really ginned up the public interest and the media interest in this case. And then when it did finally go to trial, I think it probably had more media coverage, more news organizations on site than any previous trial to that point.
And the trial lasted a long time.
It did, and much to the trial judge's consternation, I think he really thought it was going to be probably about 4 months at most, for both cases and jury deliberations and so forth. It turned out to be about 9 months. And during that entire time, the jury was sequestered. And as you might imagine, that led to many difficulties with members of the jury. It also brought in a great deal of scrutiny and criticism as to the trial judge's courtroom management, that he was to blame for the trial dragging out. I think there were a lot of mitigating factors in there that caused it to go on for so long. But it became a lifestyle almost for many people. They were glued to their television sets. There were a couple of channels that carried the trial full from gavel to gavel every day. They had recaps at night for people who were working and missed the daytime show, so to speak. And it really became a household word. A friend of the trial judge, Judge Lancito, a friend of his, had been on a trip to Tibet. She came back and she was talking with him, and she said all anybody had to say was the trial, and everybody knew instantly that they were talking about the Simpson trial in Los Angeles.
Well, I was certainly in that category of people who followed the trial religiously and every evening watched the 30-minute wrap-ups. And it's one of those moments in our history of this country where many people can tell you where they were when they heard the verdict. So here you are, Jerry Ann Haislett. You're doing your job, and you were familiar with high-profile trials. But this must have been something when this crossed your desk and your life changed with the onset of this trial, and you too took notes like many others. And I don't know whether you were thinking about writing a book at that time, but you wound up writing a book about the trial.
At that time, I did not. I took notes because I was a former newspaper journalist, and it was just second nature to have a notepad and pen with me. When anything occurred, I just jotted notes about it. As this proceedings became more and more high profile, more people involved, I started taking notes I took more accurate notes too, as a memory jogger. If somebody had said something later on, they said, "Well, I didn't say that," or I had promised them something or they wanted something. I had my notes to jog my memory, to go back and double check, to make sure that I followed through, and so forth. And then after the trial was underway for a few weeks, my husband, who was a saint through all of this, suggested that I perhaps make an audio record, like just talking to my tape recorder, on the way home from court every night. I had about nearly an hour-long commute home in the evenings, and I would get home, and I would be so wound up and so completely flummoxed and sometimes even outraged at the antics and the things that occurred, and I would just bend his ear constantly. You won't believe what happened today. And it was interesting to him, but he did not want a steady diet of that every single night. So I think it was a little bit of self-preservation. Julianne, why don't you tell that to your tape recorder? So I ended up with a really good record, both written and audio record.
Well, think back to that time. I guess maybe you've just answered that, but I answered the question. But I was going to say, what was it like? How did you keep your grounding throughout that? Because we're going to talk in a minute about some of the stories about some of the crazy things people did. But you had to, I guess, at least in your job duties, you had to be the one who kept the cool.
Well, a lot of people did keep their cool. I think I had a little bit more public position because I was dealing with the news media every day. I did have access to not just the trial judge, but other judges in the court system who had a vital interest in what was going on. I had to keep my cool so that I could think through the consequences of various things that were coming up, that were being proposed and suggested. Okay, if you do this, think through and what will happen as a result of that. So it was really important that I try to do that, and also to try to keep in mind that I could not provide preferential treatment to anybody in the news media. They are very vigilant about anything that even perceives to be favorable action or access to anybody. So those were things that kind of motivated me to make sure I stayed as even and objective as I could. And it did get to the point that my whole MO was, I am going to put one foot in front of the other and take things as they came, deal with things as well as I could, and try to get through every day completely so that if I had phone calls I hadn't been able to get through during the day, I would sit in my driveway after I got home and return those phone calls so that I wouldn't have anything left over, carried over to the next day, and also so the news media would know that I was making an effort to be responsive to them, knowing that they had deadlines.
So as a former reporter, you knew how you needed to deal with the media, it sounds like.
Yes. I felt like I did. I think at times they thought I didn't. But I feel like, I know that that was a good grounding for me to have that experience. And in fact, the fact that I was with the news media was a reason, one reason that the judges hired me for that position in the first place. They wanted someone who not only understood how the media operated, why they did what they did, but could explain that to judges, because there is a total mystification with the courts. And I say that in a sweeping gesture, that there are many judges who are quite media savvy, but for the most part, the vast majority don't understand the news media. They have a completely different orientation and culture. To a large extent, that's true of the news media, members of the media not understanding how and why the courts and why judges do what they do. So I was very pleased to have the opportunity to try to demystify each but the courts to the media to the courts.
Do you have any idea how many media people were involved in covering the trial?
The court relied on local law enforcement credentialing. So if a member of the media had a sheriff's or a police department credential, the court recognized that as a valid credential. They say they issued 1,300 credentials. I know a lot more people were on site, the courthouse, both inside the courthouse while not in the courtroom.
My guest today is Jerrianne Haislett, and she is author of the book Anatomy of a Trial, Public Loss, Lessons Learned from the People versus O.J. Simpson. She was in the middle of the media circus, and we're going to gossip a little bit. There's some good gossip in this book, Ms. Haislett, and one of the stories is everybody wanted, all the high-profile people around the country in TV shows and media wanted an interview with Judge Ito. Tell us the Katie Couric story.
Well, that came up when I was not the supervisor of the information office. For a brief time, the Superior Court, where I worked, and the Municipal Court, which is a lower-level court, had merged, and the information officer from the Municipal Court was appointed supervisor of the office simply because she had longevity. And so, unbeknownst to me, she had arranged for Katie Couric to visit Judge Ito. It was not an interview opportunity, but simply, I really don't know what was in, why she did it, because she did it unbeknownst to me, and she took me over there and said, I've got a surprise. She took me in a back door of the courthouse and into Judge Ito's chambers, and shortly here came Katie Couric. And as I described in the book, it felt like sort of a surreal moment to me, like, what is going on here? And Katie and her assistant were in the judge's chambers chatting up the judge. And I don't think it's something I would have done had it been me, but it sort of set the stage, like, oh, that's been done once. So when another opportunity came up and I thought it might be beneficial to both the judge and whoever was making the request, then I would ask him about it.
Well, it had the feel of that Katie Couric found a way to just get a little FaceTime, circumvent the process, and, as you say, chat him up. And as you say in the book, she just said, oh, and if you are ever ready to give an interview, please let me be the person, or something like that.
She wanted
to be the one who got the interview with Judge Ito.
As did they all. She just got the inside track by, I suppose, having some, either she herself or having someone on her staff contact Marcia Skolnick, who was the boss in the information office at the time. So I guess the thinking was no harm, no foul, as long as we keep it secret.
Yeah. Well, and you and I've both been on the reporter side of things. As a reporter, you're going to do whatever you can to try to get the interview, get the information.
You better believe it. But what a coup, yeah, had Katie been able to get an interview with him and no one else had.
Exactly. But the other thing that was, it was so sad for me to read, because I'm always trying to defend the media and defend what reporters do, but boy, you just had all these prima donnas who all thought that the rules didn't apply to them, and they just flat out brazenly broke rules. The woman who refused to wear her badge?
Yes. It was sad for me. I didn't want to see that happening. Yet I understood. These people want to have a leg up. They want some kind of an advantage. If it means breaking a rule in order to do it, I'll do it. More important than whether or not they followed the court's rules were whether or not it was job security. If they got the story, a number of people with the media went on, I mean, it launched their careers. David Gregory, for instance. I'd never heard of David Gregory until he showed up in the media center of the Simpson trial, or Terry Moran. These people were not household names. They were not on national TV the way they are now, and I really believe that trial was at least a stepping stone, if not a launching pad for them. The members of the media know that, and if it means breaking a rule in order to be able to advance their careers, to hang on to their jobs, whatever, they'll do it.
But this woman wouldn't wear her badge because she didn't want to pierce her silk clothing, and she wound up getting kicked out of the courtroom, if I remember correctly.
She did entirely, not as she was excluded one day because of that. She was truly an anomaly, just as this trial, I think, was an anomaly in the history of jurisprudence in this country. Kristen Jeanette Myers was an anomaly so far as members of the media are concerned. She was an on-camera personality. She started out in the Rodney King beating trial behind the camera on the delay switch, and she wanted very much to be in front of the camera, and she worked her way into doing that by the time the Simpson trial came along. But she wore beautiful silk suits. Her grooming was impeccable. She had such an adorable face, and she could manipulate not only her expressions to suit whatever it is that she wanted, but she was excellent at manipulating other people, particularly men. And after she was excluded from the courtroom because she wouldn't wear her badge, next thing you know, she was right back in, and it turned out she'd gone to the sheriff's sergeant, and and he just said, oh, she can just, you know, clip it through her handbag. That's okay. And that's what the courtroom deputies are saying. But no, we can't see the badge if it's on her handbag.
Well, our time is getting away so quickly, and we've got to talk about cameras in the courtrooms. But first, we've got to do Marcia Clark, because she doesn't come across very well. She was the prosecutor, and you described some behavior that really turned off the jurors toward her, you think. Can you give us that story?
I really believe she did have a negative impact, and the unfortunate thing is I think she thought she was relating to them. They were relating to her. She was a highly paid prosecutor, a woman who had child care issues. She leaned on the court to alter the starting time of the trial so she could get her children to their daycare and so forth, and invariably she would come in late. Even though the trial court convened half an hour late every day for her convenience, she couldn't get there on time, and she would come in. She would not make a pretense of trying to be quiet or unobtrusive. It was almost a sense of entitlement. Well, I'm here now; things can start. And the female jurors, the majority of them were African American, and I think they thought, "Hey, we know what child care issues are, and lady, we're not very sympathetic with you."
Yeah, because most people don't get that kind of accommodation because of their personal issues.
Mm-hmm, right. So well, I think she impacted them in a negative way.
And you say in the book that she alternated between being hostile and flirtatious toward the other legal team.
Well, particularly Johnny Cochran. He was a charming, charming man. She could be very vitriolic towards him in addressing the court, and addressing him when court isn't, you know, wasn't on the record, even though she wasn't supposed to. And then she would turn around if they had a little, something she wanted to, an aside to him in his ear. It was almost as if she was, like, going to hug him or give him a kiss on the cheek, and she would laugh and be almost flirtatious. It was an interesting phenomenon from my point of view.
All right, we've got to get down to the big issue, the more long-lasting issue instead of the fun gossip. Cameras in the courtroom. A lot of people judged Ito harshly, said that he played to the cameras, said that the cameras caused things to get out of proportion, and people had a very, very negative view of him and of camera coverage of trials. What did you learn about that as a first-hand observer?
As a first-hand observer, and I will be the first to concede that I met with him daily. I worked for the court. I took direction from him and so forth. But I do think that I also had a rather objective viewpoint. I think he was naive in many respects, but I think he was very well-meaning in many respects. I don't think he played to the camera in that he wanted the camera to be on him. I think he was aware of the camera, and because of its presence, he wanted to be perceived as being fair, objective, giving both sides equal opportunity, not coming down harder on one side than the other. Unfortunately, there were just so many things that went into what was going on with the camera. His rationale for having it placed where he wanted to have it placed, which was on the wall behind the jurors' heads. His intention was so that the public, viewing public, could see the case from the viewpoint of the jurors. That got interpreted that, oh, it was so the camera would have a better shot of him. So there are a number of things that went into camera coverage that I think worked against him, but he never wavered from his belief that the camera should be there. The public had a right to see what was going on, and he is one of the few judges in the Los Angeles court system who, since the Simpson trial, have routinely allowed cameras in his court proceedings when he gets requests. And, of course, nothing has ensued like the Simpson trial with the cameras in his courtroom. But he is a passionate believer of being a public servant, and he had to take the negative and the criticism along with the good. I think his naivete contributed to some of the consequences, though.
I've been a proponent of cameras in courtrooms for years, and while I watched that trial, my perspective was that even those things seemed to be insane outside the court and in the coverage, that when the trial was underway, that the camera just captured what was going on. Am I seeing that somehow through rose-colored glasses?
I don't think you are. That was certainly my perception as well. And it was reinforced by a radio reporter who said at one time, this was a National Public Radio reporter, who really took umbrage at the fact that there was a circus in the courtroom. And she said that the circus atmosphere was outside the courtroom, not in the courtroom. And people who criticize either have not looked at the full footage or, and I think this is more important, have not read the transcript of the trial. The transcript is available, and even judges who have criticized Judge Ito and his courtroom management will criticize, but they have not read the trial transcript. And Judge Ito has an open invitation to any judge who would like to take issue with anything, to contact him, to call. He is very willing to talk to any judge who wants to talk. talk to him about it.
Okay, time is getting away very quickly. What were the biggest mistakes that Judge Ito made?
The interview with the KCBS reporter. It was supposed to focus on the Japanese American internment camps during World War II. The two people who met there became his parents, and Judge Ito has a great sense of duty to try to inform the public about that. And despite all warnings, please don't do that, he did do the interview, and I think that was a huge turning point. He also, after the camera caught an alternate juror, it was a mistake, but it still happened. The alternate juror got on camera. He limited the focus and the movement of the TV camera so that it was a stationary, medium-wide shot of the courtroom well. Everything that was going on in the trial could be captured, but the camera was not allowed to zoom in, it was not allowed to pan or anything. And he kept that in place until Court TV, which was staffing the camera, satisfied his other conditions, and then he let it go back to being able to pan and zoom and so forth. I think it would have been far better to leave it as a static shot. The media did not like that. It said it was ugly, that it was not interesting, and I'm saying that's not the point of having the camera there. The point of having the camera there was to let the public see the trial.
And the reason that you're talking about that is because it's illegal to photograph jurors, and accidentally it happened.
It is in California and all states except Florida.
Okay.
Florida will allow the photography and video taping of jurors.
Jerry Ann Haislett, are you still working with Los Angeles Superior Court?
I'm not. I left the court in 2002 and moved to Wisconsin. I worked for a number of years as an international consultant, media relations.
I know about your website, and I'll give that information. It's www.anatomyofatrial.com, all spelled out, anatomyofatrial.com. But where else can people get your book?
It is available at the University of Missouri Press. Also, it's on Amazon.com. It's available both in hard copy and digitally.
All right. And again, the name of the book is Anatomy of a Trial, Public Loss, Lessons Learned from the People versus O.J. Simpson, and the website, anatomyofatrial.com. Jerry Ann Haislett is the author and has been our guest. Thanks to First Bank and Trust for their sponsorship of this program, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in to 90.7.